If you think women composers are new, think again. The music you're hearing was composed by a woman named Hildegard von Bingen back in medieval times. Spiritus Sanctus Vivicans Vita. It's the first piece in a program this Friday evening celebrating women composers, starting with Hildegard von Bingen and concluding with a contemporary composer who lives and works here in Kansas City right now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we are talking about women composers throughout history. We'll hear some of the music they've created, and we'll find out why we don't know the name Elisabeth Jacquet de la Guerre, the way we know Johann Sebastian Bach, who lived at around the same time. Because guess what? She was plenty famous too, back then. Elizabeth Selain is with me now. She's with us from the Bach Aria Soloists, and it's their upcoming performance that inspired this discussion. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gina.
Tell me a little bit about how this show came about.
Well, we did a concert last year, actually, of all women composers. It was a smaller format, and it was a house concert, and we had such a great time.
A housing concert.
A house concert.
Yeah, yes. I'm intrigued by those, but go on. Okay. We'll discuss some other time.
Sure. We were so excited by learning the music and working on it together and the audience's reaction to all of these supernova women. And we decided that we needed to do this in a larger, more public format. So we decided this year would be the year, and so we're doing it at the 1900 building, and it's chock filled with incredible composers, as you said, from the Middle Ages all the way to today, with four living composers' pieces.
Well, we're also joined by Allison DeSimone. She's a musicologist at UMKC's Conservatory. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We are going to dig into the individual stories of the composers on this program, and we'll do that very shortly. But just looking at the program on the whole, what strikes you about it?
I love how diverse it is. I mean, each of these women has such a unique and such an exceptional story behind how they got into music and how their careers developed. But each of them sort of, you know, they're each a piece of a larger story about how women have been in music for centuries and centuries, but also why we don't know as much about them as we do, as you said earlier, about Johann Sebastian Bach and other more famous male composers.
So what's the short answer to that, though? Why don't we? I mean, I can make my own assumptions about that.
There are a lot of short answers to that, but I'd say one of them is that traditionally men have written history. And so, you know, it's only been across the past maybe 100 years, maybe even more recently than that, that people have gotten more interested in rediscovering music by underrepresented people, whether that's gender or race or whatever it may be.
So do you think that, like, today, these women are no longer here, with the exception of the contemporary composer, obviously, but just even thinking about history, having their music performed live by musicians in Kansas City today, mm-hmm. what does that do as far as like how that history does live on?
Well, I think it's important to perform this music because it provides exposure. I mean, that's essentially what these performances are for. It's not that this music has just been recently rediscovered. We've known about a lot of these composers for a long time, but their music hasn't always been accessible in modern performing editions or on CD or recorded music, for example. So it's really important not only to hear live performances like Bach Aria Soloist Concert this Friday, but also to record this music and get it out there so that people are aware that female composers have been around since at least the 12th century, if not before.
And so when we say they've been around this whole time, that is not to say that their path has always been easy. And I want to start with Hildegard von Bingen, who mm-hmm. we just heard her music. Mm-hmm. Her story is pretty wild. And I want you to tell me if I am remembering this correctly mm-hmm. from music history. She was a cloistered nun, I believe, mm-hmm. at a time when women were not allowed to interpret sacred texts. And she had either migraines or visions, depending on who you ask. But the force of these experiences was undeniable enough that she was granted, I guess, like almost special permission mm-hmm. to do what these visions demanded. Am I remembering that basically correctly?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
she's a mystic.
Yeah.
talk to me about like the context in which she lived and what she maybe had to overcome to get her music out there. I mean, had she not been overcome with visions, would her talent be lying dormant right now?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the reasons why she was able to get her music out there was because she was part of the church. And in that time, the only people who had access to education would have been, you know, music education included, would have been people who were a part of the Catholic Church and who worked in that capacity. So, you know, she was then granted all of these special dispensations because of her visions and her work as a prophet and a seer. And she even was founded a new convent, I believe, which wasn't something that women were supposed to do at that time either. So she is certainly an exceptional woman in the context of all of these female composers on this program.
What do you think that her story kind of teaches us if we're thinking about history and the story of women in composing writ large?
Well, she never backed down. Elizabeth, what do you think?
I think in her genius is mm-hmm. undeniable. The fact that we still, can you imagine, we want to play, sing her music today from, in her music's from the 1100s. I mean, that's, you just can't deny the brilliance of her work.
What do you hear in her music? I know that we aren't hearing it anymore right now, but I think it leaves such an impression. People
yes,
know what
it
they
does.
Just heard.
It does. It's very moving. In the, you know, in the simplest form is monophonic, and if it's not done a cappella, then you heard even in this recording there was a drone, and we're going to start off a cappella completely, just Sarah, our beautiful soprano, Sarah Tannehill Anderson, singing alone, and then we'll have the cello join in on just a low drone, which is often what it was, just a, if anything, accompanying is just that voice is droning. So, but and I think it's so moving because of the purity of what it is. Not only you know, the intervals that she uses, and it's more than just a, I'd say more than just what you would hear as a chant, a Gregorian chant.
So I'm going to jump way ahead and talk about women composers now. We will fill in this larger story as we go, but we do conclude that, so you start this program with Hildegard von Bingen, and you conclude it with a piece by Chen Yi. What would you say, how would you say Chen Yi fits into a story of women composers today?
Well, she is larger than life also. And she's such a positive, cheerful, joyous force to be around. And her music is just like that. And I think you feel delighted when you while you're playing the music. And I think the audience also feels full of delight while they're listening to the music. And you know, that positivity, not only the fact that she is a great composer and the music is great, but you feel her energy in the music, and I think that's what has made her stand out from all the other composers and brought her, well, it's, she has brought herself a tremendous amount of success.
So we're listening now to Chen Yi, and we're going to listen a little bit, and then let's talk about what we're hearing. Elizabeth, this is the Bach Aria Soloist performing.
Yes.
This is your group. Can you talk to me about what it's like to perform Chen Yi's music?
Well, this is the romance, part of the romance and dance. And you can hear that she's trying to emulate certain Chinese string instruments. And because you know that that's what she's wanting to express, I try to really exaggerate and try to sound like the, you know, the Chinese style. I can't pronounce the word correctly, but I know what she has in mind. And she came to our concert last year, and I was able to speak to her about it. And she said that it was very convincing. You know, all of the, you know, you add a lot more glissandi, and you do things.
What is glissandi?
That is a slide from one note to another, and you know, you can really vary the tempo in which you do that to exaggerate or not to exaggerate. It could be really quick, or in this case, I tried to do it really slowly. And it's very romantic music, beautiful to play, beautiful to listen to. And then the dance, the second part of it is a very upbeat, a little more kind of confrontational music. But it starts off also with an ancient violin sound in the beginning, and then she goes immediately into this quicker, upbeat, really fun and quirky 16th note rhythmic piece.
What do you think gender has to do with how people view Chen Yi, or maybe don't.
I don't think it matters at all in playing her music. You don't even notice. I mean, there's no reason to really notice, I don't think. I think if someone didn't realize she was a female, I don't think they would care that she is or that she isn't. You know, it's just great music, and that I find that with all of the pieces of hers that I've heard.
I mean, is that sort of the message of this program? Like, this is just great music?
And it is fantastic music. And as Allison pointed out, it's very diverse from one to another. Every single voice on the program is completely different. And you hear, I mean, you just can't imagine that not everybody knows about these women that we'll be performing.
Allison DeSimone, I mean, if you were to, can you see like a bigger, like a story or a journey that connects someone like Hildegard von Bingen to someone like Chen Yi, a woman working today as a composer? Is there a narrative arc there?
That's a good question. I wouldn't go so far as to say that we should generalize that much, because again, these are all individual people with their own individual stories. But I do think that of all of these are women who, for better or worse, for better, have made it, right? I mean, I guess for lack of a better term is what I meant. They've made it. They have these careers, their names, they're known, and they're being resurrected from history. But for all of these women, there are scores of other women who haven't been yet, or who are not maybe appreciated for their contributions to music as patrons or as female patrons or as female teachers of music. That's always underrated as a profession. So I would say that the narrative that might link all of these is that these are women who did overcome certain things to be able to have the careers that they did in their lifetimes. And now they're overcoming, you know, the test of time to reemerge in musical life today.
Why are there periods? I mean, I get the feeling that there are periods in Western music where you see women very actively composing and sort of with more visibility, and then periods where that's not so much the case. Can those ebbs and flows be explained by politics, religion, other forces?
All of the above. Yeah, it's a lot of different things. And it really depends on the geographical location of these women. A lot of it has to do, too, with the fact that most of the women on these lists had family members who were musicians, and more importantly, had male family members who were musicians.
Right.
So someone like Barbara Strozzi, her father, her adoptive father, was a prominent librettist in Venice when she lived in the mid-17th century. Someone like Clara Schumann was born into a family of musicians. So it was because of this that they were sort of allowed to have more prominent public careers than many other women would have been.
And the men, as Allison said, the men who they were surrounded by are also helping to promote and support their work, mm-hmm. which is
right.
Really fortunate for actually several of the women on this program.
Okay, so let's talk about a woman by the name of Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre. I mentioned her before. She was super famous in her own time, was she mm-hmm. not?
Absolutely.
Right.
Tell her story.
So Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre was a child prodigy. She lived and worked during Louis XIV's reign. And when she was a young child, her father, who was a musician, brought her to court and said, play for the king. And so she performed for him, and he supported her in her career. His mistress at the time also supported her, which helped a lot as well. And so she was a virtuoso harpsichordist, but as her career developed, she also began to compose operas. She composed chamber cantatas, violin sonatas, and she was really revered to the point where a music historian of the day put her on Mount Parnassus with all of the other major French composers of her day, which is pretty special.
Let's hear a little bit of her sonata number one. Elizabeth Salane, tell me about
yes.
what you hear in this.
I'm hearing how I do it differently. but really, that first movement is absolutely amazing, because she just writes almost only neumes or just whole notes through the whole thing. And you're supposed to embellish throughout. And of course, you can set the tone exactly as this violinist is doing. And then after that, you're supposed to continually embellish because there's a lot of repetition. But it's incredible because it leaves you a lot of room for improvisation, fantasy. And most of her music is like that. And so,
leaving room for the performer.
Yes. So every performer who performs is going to sound completely different as this one does from how I do it. And that's the really fun part about just putting your own, you know, own style, own signature into her music. And each movement, I mean, the other thing about this sonata that's really unusual is that it's got a huge number of movements, I think something like 8 movements. And we've done the first half of the sonata in a couple of different concerts this year. So our audience has been hearing Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre several times this year. And this is the last time they're going to hear her this year on our concert. And we're doing the final 3 movements. So they haven't heard those movements before, but they've heard a bunch of other movements, you know. And
it is interesting to me that she was known by a king in her own time, and that I am hearing her name really for the first time in preparation for this show, in spite of the fact that I've heard many names of many composers who lived during her same time. And, you know, I'm not a music expert, but you breathe today and you know certain composers' names.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she's not one of them.
Well,
yeah,
don't
no,
you think?
It's true.
Yeah.
I think, again, this goes back to the fact that, well, there are two things. I think one of them is that there are also a lot of other male French composers from this period that we don't know about, or that most people haven't heard about.
Many people get lost
right,
to the story.
Many people get lost,
time.
And there are really only a select few that become these canonical composers. But yeah, I think also because of the fact that she was a woman and not maybe as published as widely as some of her male contemporaries.
Exactly.
Yeah, she's been lost.
So if you think about it's how many centuries, 5 centuries since then. So, you know, for her to have been sustained till now, she had to have been discovered or supported or you know, beloved by later generations in order for her to remain to today.
Right.
There's another woman on the Bach Aria Soloist program for this Friday who was kind of a celebrity in her own time, Barbara Strozzi. She wrote opera, and we're not going to play her music today. You can hear that on Friday night, but we actually did a whole show with her, with a local singer, Victoria Botero. Remind us of Barbara Strozzi's story.
Sure, yeah. She's a fascinating person. She was born as an illegitimate daughter to a man, a very prominent Venetian patron of the arts in the mid-17th century. So because of his access to famous people, she was able to take composition lessons with a student of Monteverdi. So her compositional legacy goes back to one of the most important composers of the 17th century. But she wrote primarily for her own voice, which is really interesting. So all of her music, these vocal chamber pieces, are written for her own voice. They have this really beautiful, intimate quality to them, which I just love.
We will get right back to this conversation about the history of women as composers of classical music when KCUR's Central Standard returns. If there's a woman whose music compositions you wish more people knew, you can call us and tell us about her at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about classical music by women composers, some of whom were very famous in their own times, only to be, I guess, somewhat forgotten by history. So we're kind of talking about why that is and how you fix it. One of the ways is to start by playing their music so that people know about it, and that is what the Bach Aria Soloists are doing this Friday at the 1900 building downtown in a program called Celebrating Women. It starts at 7:30, and Elizabeth Selane of the Bach Aria Soloists is with us now. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Gina.
We are also joined by musicologist Allison DeSimone. Hi again to you.
Hello.
So you can call 816-235-2888 if you have a personal connection with this topic, whether you're part of the classical musical world today, or if you have a special interest in a composer who you wish more people knew about. 816-235-2888. And I am curious what you think about whether remembering women who composed music alongside, say, Bach in his time and in their times, if we start to say their names the way we say those other composers' names, Does that make a difference for women who are trying to get their work out today?
Certainly. Just any kind of constant conversation about anybody that you want to be known, I think, is definitely really important.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. I think, you know, in music history classes or even in public musicology like this, there are so many ways of using music by female composers instead of the music by Bach or Handel to illustrate whatever points you want to make. And I think more of
about
that,
a time period.
About a time period, right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think more of that is absolutely necessary and I think would really help promote new music by women and composers as well.
And in fact, Gina, you know, in this concert, we're kind of representing each era with one of these women or two of these women. And you'll hear when you get to the Romantic period, certainly with Clara Schumann and Fanny Mendelssohn.
And we'll be hearing them soon.
Yes. Well, their music is, I would venture to say, just as good, if not better, than their much more renowned male counterparts.
Such as?
Well, you know, Robert Schumann and then Felix Mendelssohn for, with Fanny, Fanny's brother. So, and even Felix is known to have said that his sister was a much more talented pianist than he was, and so much of her music is for piano.
But Elizabeth Salane, you are a violinist, but you're also the leader of this respected musical group in town, the Bach Aria Soloists, and I wonder if there is work to be done in garnering respect and visibility in those arenas, or if those battles are not. Are those battles that are being fought today for visibility as a musician, for visibility as someone who leads a group?
You mean for women?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Kansas City, it seems that there are a lot of women leaders of all kinds of organizations, especially small not-for-profits, I've noticed. In fact, I've been so pleased by this, you know, having moved to Kansas City, that I feel like I would like to do something to celebrate all of these women who are leading these great organizations for smaller not-for-profits. Now, as in terms of composers being represented, women composers being represented overall in the music, in the classical music community in the United States, I think that women have it so much better now, women composers. There are so many living women composers now, which is fabulous. But if you still look at, for example, orchestral programming, you do not see these women being programmed nearly as much as all of the renowned men that we all, you know, that we all hear.
Do you feel like you're filling in the gaps with a program like this Fridays?
Well, hopefully this will help to introduce Kansas City audiences to all of these women that maybe they've never even heard before.
Because then audience recognition, like name recognition, would be a big part of that. It's hard for a big performance organization to sell tickets to a concert when nobody recognizes the name on the bill.
And this is always the justification for not doing it, you know. So I do understand that, of course, as a director of an organization. But what do you think, Allison?
Yeah, no, I think it's really important, you know, the exposure and the name recognition for something, you know, like playing a Clara Schumann piece on your concert this Friday. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe in a few years that'll inspire the Kansas City Symphony to program a piano concerto.
Right,
But audiences have to want it. And so, you know, hopefully those attending on Friday will make their voices heard that they love this music by these women and that other groups around town, especially the bigger, you know, the bigger ensembles will take up the mantle and do some as well.
Yes.
All right. Well, so let's get back to the project of familiarizing. Let's talk about Fanny Mendelssohn. Her name just came up. Tell me her story.
Sure. Yeah. So as Elizabeth already said, she was born not into a musical family. Her father was actually a banker, but they were a very prominent family in Germany during their lifetimes. Her brother was Felix Mendelssohn, who became a very famous musician and composer. But Fanny was herself a wonderful pianist,
really wonderful.
And also a wonderful composer. She hosted a salon, so she was mingling with all of these musical people. But she was very afraid of publishing her own music during her lifetime because she was of this upper class and was worried that she would be seen as perhaps overstepping the bounds of her gender. So I believe she didn't publish any of her music until the year before her death.
Oh.
And she died at 41. So, you know, think about what a career she could have had, had she lived longer than that.
Yes, and I think society really did squash a lot of these women's aspirations, you know, to do more for themselves. And they ended up supporting instead and promoting the music of their male counterparts. So Fanny would
in
play
her, case,
her brother's mm-hmm. music. Yeah, or Clara would constantly was the biggest champion of her husband's music.
Let's hear a little bit of Fanny Mendelssohn's music from, I guess, the 1 year when she was publishing her music.
Great.
Elizabeth?
Yes.
Why did you pick this? What do you love about it?
Oh, I love this. I love this. It's just so rich and, you know, luscious to listen to play. So Mendelssohnian. I mean, I hear this and I wonder, did he steal from his sister? Because it sounds so similar.
Do you think that there could be something to, like, two siblings just kind of being influenced by similar forces? And
No doubt.
Okay.
And also Felix even published a piece of hers as his own. So, you know. You just listen to this and you hear Felix Mendelssohn. But
when you say Mendelssohnian, what does that mean?
The harmonies, the motives, you'll hear later, it's almost a quote. And so I wonder, I would like to think that she's not quoting him, he's quoting her all the time. I mean, there's something that sounds exactly like a quote from one of his piano trios. And, you know, this piano trio, I mean, we never play piano trios, really. We do play piano trios from the Baroque period, but it's with harpsichord, you know, it's a keyboard trio with, it's really continuo. Continuo means harpsichord plus a bass instrument. So we don't normally get the luxury of playing with piano, this piano trio, romantic piano trio repertoire. Not usually. So this will be a real treat for people to hear Elisa Williams-Bickers, our keyboardist, playing on that gorgeous Steinway piano that they have.
I mean, I would think that a piano trio would be tricky. Just having three pianos on a stage is
It's actually one piano with violin and cello. That's
Forgive me.
Trio. That's called the piano trio.
All right. Okay. Sorry about that. Total novice over here. Okay. We're going to play before we go another piece, but first I would like to take a call from Stephen. Hi, Stephen. What do you want to share?
Good morning. I just wanted to share a couple of things. One, it's so wonderful to hear this program. It's great to hear Elizabeth. I'm with the Youth Symphony, actually, of Kansas City, and we're so proud of Elizabeth as an alumna of the Youth Symphony. So, but apropos to this conversation, there will be a performance that Youth Symphony is having in May that features Ingrid Stolzel, who's a local composer, if you will, originally from Germany, but the Youth Symphony commissioned a piece for the 60th anniversary this year that will be premiered at Helzberg Hall in May, written by Ingrid.
Excellent.
So, thanks for letting us know, Stephen.
So we're just thrilled for her to have written this piece, and it's entitled City Beautiful, and it's based upon the City Beautiful movement that inspired the parks and boulevard system here in Kansas City.
Very cool. Oh, cool. Thank you so
nice.
Much.
Thanks.
And that is specifically something that's going to be performed by youth, which, again, as far as increasing name recognition, and also we have interviewed Ingrid Stolzel on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that she said is that it took her a while, even in her own progress as a young musician, as mm-hmm. someone interested in music, to envision herself as a composer because she had not seen other women in that role particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I'm a pianist and a keyboardist. I don't think I played music by female composers until graduate school.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
right. They don't
it's just
it so
yeah,
much
it's
in,
not
in
it's not it has not been traditionally a part of the music curriculum for students performing in conservatories or schools of music, but it's becoming more so.
The only reason that I can recognize Beethoven is because I had to rehearse the Ode to Joy on the piano 1,000 times very badly. It leaves a mark in your mind.
Well, maybe that should be Jacques de la Guerre from now on.
Yes, that's right. Well, you're going to change this, right, Allison?
I hope so. I teach a class on gender and music before 1800 at UMKC, but where we are doing a lot more, I think my colleagues are so great at programming music music by women composers and having their students learn this music. So at UMKC, I think we're doing a really good job. It helps that Chen Yi is
on our course. I was just going to say that. Well, Chen Yi.
The last piece we're going to play before we go is by Clara Schumann. Allison, her name has come up quite a bit, but Allison, tell me about her. If we're going by last name recognition again, this is a familiar one.
Right, absolutely. So in fact, it's the 200th birthday this year of Clara
Schumann.
So happy birthday to her. She was a celebrated pianist and composer during her lifetime. She championed the music of her husband, who has since become more famous. But during her life, she was absolutely more famous than he was. So her music is beautiful, and I can't wait for you all to hear it on Friday.
Yes. Oh, it's so gorgeous, the piece that we're playing.
We're going out on Clara Schumann. You can hear more of her music as part of a Bach Aria Soloists program celebrating women composers at the 1900 building Friday night. Allison DeSimone, Elizabeth Salane, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
And up next, the new policy director of the ACLU of Kansas. She has quite a story of her own, and we will be hearing it on KCUR's Central Standard. And I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We are joined now by Letitia Harmon. She is stepping into a new post as policy director of the ACLU of Kansas, an organization that's been fighting a lot of battles that have gotten the nation's attention because they get to the heart of very deep anxieties and profound tensions about the direction this country is or might be headed. So before she dives into all of that, we are going to hear her story. It is pretty interesting, from work in an orphanage with kids who had HIV to prevention of gender-based violence in Kenya. Letitia Harmon, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Now, I just want to clarify, I want to correct something that people may have heard in promotion of the show just a little while ago. You are not replacing Micah Kubik.
No, and nor could anyone replace Micah Kubik.
So this is just a different position, but very important one.
I certainly hope so and think so. I'm excited about my work. But yeah, Micah was our executive director who has moved on to Florida, and I'm the policy director.
So you are a Kansas City native, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I grew up here.
Tell me about your childhood.
Well, I had a sister. I was homeschooled K through 12, living in Kansas City. And so I had that kind of unique experience of the city. And we were part of a homeschool performing arts group where a lot of my friends to this day came from, and I got to know them.
So like a community of homeschool families.
Yeah, essentially.
Tell me about that community and what you think it might have contributed to your interest in the things that you have pursued as an adult.
Right. It's a little bit difficult to always, I think, draw a direct line from where we came from
we
ended up. I think I have zigzagged to where I am and who I am. But I really value those relationships, being in a community that understood homeschooling and the value of art and the value of expression. And that was a respite when you are homeschooled and everyone considers that to be very odd and they don't quite know how to interact with you. It was nice to be with people who, okay, we just get it, and it's a much more comfortable interaction.
Where do you think that your interest in the law and civil liberties and just justice as a concept comes from? Can you trace it to like a moment?
It's hard to say a moment, because I think that something like that is very much a collection of relationships. Maybe for me, even a little bit of nature. Just my personality has always been somewhat of a revolutionary. I have always had this incredible sense of justice. Even as a young child, I would be the first to say that's not fair and explain why it wasn't fair. And I think that I am very clearly a blend of my two parents and their perspective on the world. I was brought up very religious, very strong principles, and those principles inform everything else I did. They inform the education I received, in which I challenged what I was told and sought out the truth for myself and continued to ask questions until I had arrived at rational conclusions. And I think that's what developed into this idea that there is a universal justice, that there are universal human rights, that all people should be treated with dignity and fairness. And unfortunately, they are not being treated so. And it's incumbent on those of us who are in positions where we can advocate for them, where we can voice for the voiceless, to do that.
It sounds, if I may interpret what you're saying and see if I got it right, it sounds like there were strong principles in your household and that you also learned to articulate your own strong principles in response to that.
I think that's fair to say, yeah.
But you did not have what I would call an easy path through your education and schooling to get where you are up through like graduate school. This path involves divorce, foreclosure, mm-hmm. bankruptcy. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that? Can you tell that piece of your story?
Sure. As much as I can. I think that my education, my undergrad actually went fairly smoothly. I was supported by family during that time. I was able to work while I was in school. And I had opportunities such as being an associate student at Oxford University, which when I was there, I thought I was going to be an English major. So I was reading English romantic literature, and there's still a very soft spot for that. My dogs are named Byron and Keats. So, you know, that's still very much a part of me. But I got on this international relations trajectory from there. Immediately after graduating, I worked at a local homeless shelter, actually Kansas City Rescue Mission. And I married my first boyfriend, and he decided to pursue his education in New Jersey. While we were there, it was just very financially strapped. I was working 4 jobs at a time, trying to keep us afloat. We had done what all of the people who made their money in the 90s recommended we do, which is purchase property in Kansas City as an investment. Unfortunately, we did that in 2006, 5 and 6. So you kind of know what happened after that. And we had these houses that were upside down in the market, couldn't pay for things. And I had this sort of surreal existence where I would be working at a dog shelter in the morning, like scraping poop out of cages. And then I would go teach French at a community college in the afternoon. And that was a big chunk of my time. But yeah, over the years, realized that my first husband's and my professional trajectories were not the same. And I wanted to go to grad school in Seattle and continue this international relations degree. And eventually we did get divorced. And I was able to start at grad school. But through all the trauma of that divorce, of declaring bankruptcy, I had medical emergencies around the same time. I actually had to take some time off from graduate school to recover. Go to therapy and work through some things. And yeah, but that I actually consider that a serious triumph for me was when I defended my thesis finally and finished graduate school.
Because of the long path you had taken to get
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it felt like I had earned this. I had worked hard for this.
What was it that you wanted to do out there in the world that you were willing to make all of these sacrifices?
Well, initially, it was actually So I specialized specifically in political economy and human rights in South Asia. I was especially interested in finding the economic roots that propelled human trafficking. And so part of what I wrote as my thesis was about the push-pull factors impacting trafficking from Nepal to India. And that aspect of especially women's rights, but human rights in general, was what I mostly wanted to find the root cause of and be at the forefront of combating.
And so this ultimately takes you to an orphanage in Nepal?
In a way of speaking, it actually, that's not exactly the order it happened
right.
in, but yeah, I was in, but the interest was there. And I went to Nepal for an internship, actually working with Tibetan refugees as part of the Himalayan Society for Women's and Youth Empowerment. And then in the afternoon, I would volunteer at an orphanage for HIV infected and affected orphans as well.
Can you share just what that time in your life was like and what you learned in this setting?
Sure. I will try. It was pivotal. I think what that did do, because that was at a moment immediately prior to my divorce, immediately prior to my acceptance to graduate school, that confirmed you need to follow your own path. This is what you're about. This is fundamental to who you are, and you need to pursue it. And so living in Nepal for that brief time really confirmed what I was interested in doing and the path I was on, and I became more committed to it.
Can you explain that a little more? Like what you saw, what because you're saying that this is like pivotal to who mm-hmm. you are and what you want to do. Can yeah. you share some of what you saw, some of what you witnessed or hoped for in this setting?
I think what it did was illuminate how extraordinary humans are who are fighting for themselves, fighting for their own rights and freedom, and how large these systems are that can oppress them. And if you think of, for example, Tibetan refugees and massive international forces that have pushed them to where they are, and the reason that they are primarily in Nepal right now is because the government there was friendly to having them there. And so they've formed micro communities there. And in terms of the children that I worked with, they lived in a compound, which they very rarely went into or out of. I was very, very fortunate to be in one of those compounds where the caretakers genuinely loved the kids. Some of my colleagues had other experiences where there was abuse occurring. The folks I worked with were so invested in those children. And I mean, anyone who works with children, you know, I mean, they are the best and the worst of humanity. And you see that and you see how restricted they are. And you look at the girls who are 16, HIV positive, and you start thinking when she turns 18 and she can't be here anymore, she probably can't get married. She may not get work. That's the stigma that society has attached to being HIV positive. And you start to wonder what is beyond this for her and what is the role of all of society in creating a space for her to live her life and have agency in that life.
And so these questions and your commitment to seeing them these questions through, that propelled you through the rest of your grad school experience?
It really did. Yeah, it really did. It was personal at that point. I had names, I had faces that I was thinking of, and that carried on through after graduate school. I was hired by a firm in D.C., Strategic Applications International, and they sent me to work on gender-based violence prevention in Kenya. And so, yeah, and then we worked with the Justice Department here in the United States on finding solutions to human trafficking in U.S. border cities.
And you also, you worked on Obama's initiative on 21st century policing?
I did. I was, yeah, part of the support staff for the task force.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain, first of all, what that initiative was?
Yes, I will try to summarize. It was
back in the Wayback Machine.
Yes, in the Wayback Machine, which I think a lot of us will maybe vividly remember that this was formed after the Michael Brown shooting. And President Obama created this task force to address the systemic injustices and the conflict that existed between law enforcement and the public at the time and figure out what kind of recommendations could be made. So the task force was a blend of law enforcement, chiefs of police, activists, experts in the field who could attempt to identify recommendations, solutions that would change how law enforcement impacted these communities.
Can you talk a little bit about what you were doing as part of this effort?
I was basically documenting what the recommendations are. I would listen to the expert testimony. I would track that. I transcribed quite a bit of the task force proceedings and then pull from the expert testimony would pull actionable recommendations out of that. And that was part of the report that we gave to the president and from there to the Justice Department.
Do you have a memory of just as you watch the news today, like, do you have a memory of something that was said during any of those hearings or conversations that just like reverberates in your mind?
I do remember specifically any interaction I had with Brian Stevenson, who was on the task force and is kind of well known for his work in the space and his history as a civil rights lawyer. And I remember my interaction with him and being so impressed that in spite of being in this world where you meet people who are working on good things, but sometimes they may not be the most pleasant of people and they may be a little high maintenance or maybe
not soft and cuddly.
Not exactly soft and cuddly. And people that you otherwise like but turn out to be quite sexist in private, you know, these sorts of things. And then to meet this person of such incredible integrity, consistent on everything he said and did. And I So I just kind of hung on his every word. And you could tell the rest of the task force did, too. When he spoke, it was like, let's pause, let's listen to Brian. So I am an evangelist for his book, Just Mercy, which I had him sign for me. And whatever you're reading right now, I tell everybody, put that down. Go read Just Mercy. Finish that.
Why? What is it about this book?
Because it is probably the most important book that I've ever read. It addresses, and I think also why I pivoted a little to realizing that there was so much to do domestically in the United States regarding justice, regarding the pursuit of freedom, that we have such an inequitable system. And what he does is articulate in a way that is both profoundly personal, but also addresses the broad and systemic nature of injustice. He tells these stories of the people that he has defended, and what led them to this point, and how he tried to defend them, how he tried to get them out of an inequitable justice system, and also the toll that took on him as a Black man, Black civil rights lawyer trying to do this.
You talk about that his work and your relationship with him really sort of turned your eyes from internationally pursuing a sense of universal justice to working within the system in the United States to focus on justice here at home. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the specific realizations that are inspiring you right now?
I think that when you look at specifically at my work in Kansas as the policy director of ACLU Kansas, what we're trying to get at is what is at the root of a lot of these things that are either oppressing Kansans or suppressing the vote, for example. We've been working on those kinds of legislative priorities that would say, okay, if we were going to address the most fundamental rights of being a human and of being an American, we would want to protect the right to vote. So I'm working on Election Day registration, which is empowering to people who can't always take off work, find childcare, necessarily, you know, get transportation on the day they need it, in order to exercise their right to vote. And in addition, in Kansas, we have a very early deadline for registering to vote. So Election Day registration enables people to come to the poll, exercise that right to vote, and have their vote counted on that day. So it is the least inconvenient way to exercise something that everyone should be allowed to do.
Now, the story of what brought you back to Kansas from D.C. is also a pretty fascinating one. I mean, it's that journey back home kind of starts with the 2016 election, right?
To some extent, it does. I was still working for that firm in D.C. However, I had come back to Kansas City to be near family, to be near aging grandparents, and that has been a really valuable decision in my life, being able to get to know my grandpa all over again, I think has been one of the more important things that has happened in the past several years. And what did happen in the 2016 election is our biggest contracts were with the Justice Department. And we knew, you know, changing administration, not the way we expected it to change, and that those funding streams were definitely going to change, and we were probably not going to have the contracts that we had before. So, you know, my supervisor gave me a call and right away was just like, just so you know, I don't know how many projects there will be. I don't know how much we'll be able to keep you employed at this point. And so gave me the heads up. This is probably going away. And so from that point, I knew, okay, I need to find a new path.
And that new path has to do with justice in Kansas very specifically. Mm-hmm. But I am curious, I mean, you've taken us through both like really inspiring experiences you've had, but also difficult challenges along your way. And I wonder, I don't want to sugarcoat really difficult experiences, like they just generally suck. But when you try to help people navigate this concept of justice and injustice, do those experiences help you?
They do. I think because, again, in my 20s, I was living at a poverty level. I was eligible for food stamps. And I thought about, okay, so I made this choice about, you know, who I married and property I bought when I was 22. Am I paying for that for the rest of my life? And to think that I couldn't ever overcome the system. And yet, there have been paths that have been opened to me by other people. And where I carried that knowledge and that experience through, but I was also able to recover from it.
Well, our time is up, but Letitia Harmon, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Letitia Harmon is the new policy director for the ACLU of Kansas, and we will probably be hearing from her about various aspects of her work there throughout her tenure. That's a wrap for today, though. You can listen back to our conversation about her life and her career, or the earlier discussion we had about women composers in classical music at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, are you getting rid of things that no longer spark joy with reckless abandon? Thanks, Marie Kondo. But before you do, we'll help you figure out how to find someone who would be very joyful to get your stuff. And if you have a tidying up tale to tell, do it tomorrow. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.